Okay, everybody. Today is Wednesday, October 18th, 2017. And I just realized that my camera is facing the wrong way. How do I change that?
Your what? Oh, I would have broken the camera if it looked at me.
Here we go. Hello, everybody. Okay, so we are, today is August 18th, 2017, and we are at United Orthodox Synagogues of Houston, Texas. And this is our first class back after Hurricane Harvey blessed us with his presence almost 2 months ago. And we are back in the shul, in the social hall in Friedman Hall, which has become, as I've explained, our one-room schoolhouse, and we're very happy to be here, and very happy to have our class schedule back on track, and we're just going to keep on keeping on. So today, we'll study Parshat Noach, and we're going to revisit something which has gotten a lot of attention from time to time, the Noach-Avraham comparison. And we'll start by looking at two psukim. Hold on one second. Mark Bushin is having trouble connecting. Go to... So we're going to start with two psukim, and then we'll ask a question. So the two psukim that are on the source book are as follows. Let's read the first one. Ela toldot Noach, Noach ish tzadik, tamim haya bedorotav. Right, everyone has that as the first pasuk. This is the line of Noach. Noach was a righteous man. He was pure. In his age. It sometimes, it's a little mistake here, some translate tamim as blameless, as pure, as perfect. The actual translation doesn't really matter for our purposes, other than the fact that we're going to see that the same word is used in describing Avraham's relationship with God with a major difference. Okay? So let's see. Ela toldot Noach. Noach is tzadik tamim haya bedorotav. Noach is perfect, then it says about Avraham. Let's read about Avraham, chapter 17. Vayehi Avraham ben tishim shana v'teisha shanim. Avraham was 99 years old. Vayera Hashem el Avraham. The Lord appeared to Avraham. Vayomer elav and said to him. Ani Kel Shaddai, I am Kel Shaddai, Hitalech Lefanai Veheye Tamim. Walk in my ways and be blameless. Okay? So, what do you make of these psukim? What's the main difference between the description of Noach and what God says to Abraham?
Noach was blameless on his own.
Right.
I had to tell him. That was his nature.
Excellent. Noach is already blameless. And what about Avraham?
He needs to be told this is what you're supposed to do.
So, right. God, no, Avraham, correct, is not yet, let's say, blameless. Not yet pure. We could use pure, whatever it is, however we're going to translate it. Noach is already called Tamim. And Avraham is told to be Tamim. Right? So, it would make you wonder, perhaps... What's Avraham missing? Right? Well, how is it that Noach already has it and Avraham doesn't have it? And this question can also become a little bit stronger if we read the famous comments of Rashi on the first pasuk of Parshat Noach, which you don't have in front of you, but I'll read for you. Ela toldot Noach, Noach ish tzadik. This is the offspring, right, of Noach. Noach was a righteous man. Tamim haya bidorotav. He was righteous in his generation, or pure or perfect in his generation. That word, that phrase, bidorotav, in Noach's generation, raised the interest of some of the commentaries. And Rashi quotes the Midrash, and he says as follows, bidorotav, that Noach was righteous in his generation. Yesh mirabotenu dorshim oto l'shvach. Kol shekein, she'ilu haya bedor tzadikim haya tzadik yoter. Noach was righteous in his generation, all the more so he would have been righteous in another generation, right? Considering how bad his generation was and all the bad influences that were surrounding him, the fact that he stayed righteous means he would have been even more so, or he certainly would have been righteous had he been living in the generation, let's say, of Abraham, where there were better influences. That's one way to look at it. Some understand this to be a negative statement about Noach. Lefi doro hayat tzadik. What does the Torah mean, according to this view, that Noach was righteous in his generation? Sure, compared to everyone else in his generation, he was righteous. V'lo haya b'doro shel Avraham. However, had he been in the generation of Avraham, lo haya nechshav l'klum. It's very strong. He would have been considered nothing, a nobody, zero. Right? So it's two very interesting ways that the rabbis fight in terms of how to understand Noach. But if you understand it according to the first view, that Noach was righteous in his generation, which was a lousy generation, a corrupt generation, a generation where Noach had to contend with terrible influences, yet he maintained his righteousness. Let's take the second view. According to the second view, that Noach was not righteous, he was only righteous compared to all the lousy people living in his generation. Had he been living in a generation of Avraham, he would have been considered nothing. What do we make of this, of the psukim? The fact that Noach is already called Tamim, and Avraham is not. Avraham is told he has to become Tamim. Right, so that's our question. If Noach was, according to this one view of the rabbis in the Midrash, was not so great, he was only great compared to every other person in his generation that was not great, how is it possible that Noach was Tamim and Avraham wasn't? And by the way, to the best of my knowledge, we have no indication that Avraham succeeded in becoming Tamim. Right? God says, walk with me and be perfect, or be pure, or be blameless. And we don't have any psukim that says, Avraham got it, he's pure. So, anyone want to venture a guess as to how Noach seems to be outshining Avraham in this case?
Well, Noach didn't have as many pressures on him. He didn't have as many things he had to live up to, did he?
Okay, let's say that that's true. He didn't have as many. What did Avraham have to live up to? Yeah, but Noah had to build a teva, build a boat, and save humanity.
Yes, but
in the face of all these bums.
Yeah, but he was assisted to do that, wasn't he?
By who?
Hashem, obviously, you know.
Not to build the boat.
No, his sons.
I don't think he built the boat on his own.
By himself?
Yeah, maybe with his sons, but okay. That's really it.
Okay, well, boat building versus internal pressures of performing.
Okay. So how does that answer the question?
I forgot what it is now.
Meaning why, how are we supposed to, what do we make of the fact that Noah?
It was harder for Abraham than it was for Noah, is what I'm saying. It was harder for him because
it was harder for him to reach that level of Tamim, right? Because all God asked of Noah was a physical labor?
Yes.
That's interesting. And what he wanted from Abraham.
It's more internal.
Oh, that's fascinating. So we're going to give Avram a pass because he had a harder job.
Yes.
Okay. That's a wonderful answer. Anybody else?
Well, say Avram.
Although, hold on one second. I don't mean to interrupt, but a lot of the things that God asked Avram to do were also physical, like lech lecha, leave.
Yes. Yes.
Right? We don't actually, it's interesting, I do not believe, we don't have any place where God asks Abraham to do any internal work. The assumption is he did it already beforehand. That's why God chose him. God chose Abraham because he had already done the work, which means we're back to the same problem we started with.
Well, Abraham had to teach it to everybody else.
Okay.
Whereas Noah just had to get all those animals and people onto a boat.
Okay, good. Okay, could be. That's good, good. Yes, Ron.
Well, the thing is, when you say Ur, what do they really mean by that? Because there's so many different influences with every society. During the time of Noah, did they, as far as taking a wife or whatever, there was no such thing as formally taking a wife or whatever.
Right. Smiles. Could be.
Could be, you know, everybody was just, hey, I...
Right, but how does that answer this question? Why
was he girl?
I don't know if it really matters. Meaning the same word is used for Noah and Abraham. Noah got there.
Oh, a different meaning
Abraham,
we have here.
Whatever the meaning is, it doesn't matter. That's what I'm saying. Abraham had not yet gotten there. So what about this whole idea that Noah wasn't so great? Had he been in the generation of Abraham, he wouldn't have been so great. What we're seeing in the text is that that's not true. Noah had some sort of character trait that God valued because he wanted Abraham to have it. Noah had it, and Abraham didn't have it. However we define blameless, pure, perfect, however we define it, Noah seemed to be ahead of the game.
And maybe Abraham represents, we're supposed to evolve and keep evolving.
Excellent, Elisheva. Okay, so let's get down to it. Let me introduce you to the Shem Mishmuel, which is a commentary on the Torah written by Shmuel Borenstein, who is the second Rebbe of the Sukhachev Hasidic dynasty, who lived from 1855 to 1926. He offers a fascinating, if not necessarily pshat-oriented, if not sort of a simple, straightforward way to understand this, he does make a very valuable point. So he starts off by quoting the Zohar. So the Zohar is Kabbalistic literature, but I think we could understand what he's getting at, even though we may not be students of Kabbalah. So I'm going to read this Shem Mishmuel, we will discuss it, because he's going to explain and try to answer our question. Hine b'Zohar HaKadosh d'Noach hu Shabbat. In the Zohar, in the Kabbalistic literature, we're on page, still the first page. hold on a second. Still on the first page, according to the Zohar, Noach is compared to Shabbat. What does that mean? V'yesh lavin. We have to understand what that means. Dihine, amru zichram levracha, gimel hamoadim hem keneged gimel haavot. We have another statement that says each of the three festivals, Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot, correspond to one of our forefathers, Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. For Rosh Chodesh keneged David. Rosh Chodesh corresponds to King David. Kemoshe Ramzu b'shas, as it is alluded to in the Talmud. V'shalach le simana David melech Yisrael chai v'kayam. The reason why David is related to Rosh Chodesh, because we have this idea that King David lives forever, and the moon, you know, keeps renewing itself. And we know, this is a Kabbalistic idea, that all of the holidays received their sanctity from Shabbat. Meaning Shabbat was given by God, and then everything else as a completely sanctified day, and everything else that has sanctity draws its sanctity from Shabbat. So they ask the question, V'im kein l'chora nired shenoach haya gadol min ha'avot. If that's the case, and Noach is like Shabbat, which is the source of sanctity, and the forefathers, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, correspond each to one of the other holidays, which gain their sanctity from Shabbat, we back to the same question. It seems that Noach is holier than the forefathers, because Noach is Shabbat. Noach is the source of sanctity. Sort of the same question that we asked. How could the Torah say that Noah has this quality that Avraham does not have? V'im kein l'chora nireh she'Noach haya gadol min ha'avot u'mi David ha'melech, and even greater than King David. K'mo she'Shabbat gedolah mi'Yom Tov, just like Shabbat is more sanctified than Yom Tov. We know, we spoke about this over Yom Kippur, that Shabbat could be considered more sanctified than, let's say, the holidays, because we have seven aliyot on Shabbat and only five aliyot on the holidays. All types of work are forbidden on Shabbat, while certain types of work are permitted on the holidays. So on those two counts, Shabbat is the holiest. And if Noach is Shabbat, it seems that Noach is holier than the Avot. And Rosh Chodesh. Vare Amru ilu haya b'derosh al Avraham lo haya nechshav klum. And then he comes back to our question. How can we say that Noach equals Shabbat, which equals the highest level of sanctity, and Avraham is only like one of the festivals? If we had the rabbis telling us that had Noach lived in the generation of Avraham, he would have been a nothing.
Simply because he came first.
Just because you're first, you're holiest? Is that...
Well, no, Shabbat came first, and right? Noach came first.
So that, right.
This leap to the fact that he's holier, I'm not making that connection yet.
Right.
Shabbat as coming first. Noach came first.
Correct. Noach is first. Shabbat is introduced before the Chagim.
Where's the
leap? That's true.
That it's necessarily holier.
Well,
in relation if to you, not Shabbat itself.
Right, well, Shabbat in relation to the Yamim Tovim, we could say is holier based on a few halachic categories, like we pointed out.
Okay.
The Aliyot and the type of, like, you're allowed to cook on Yom Tov, you're not allowed to cook on Shabbat.
So could it be holier for that time, therefore?
Well, we're doing a comparison, so we have to compare it to something. So we're comparing Yom Tov to Shabbat.
We have to compare times too, don't we?
Right, so we're comparing Yom Tov to Shabbat. Shabbat is holier. And if Noach is Shabbat...
It was the holiest thing you could attain at the time. There was nothing else.
But they're comparing them to each other.
Oh, I misunderstand.
You have to... You can't say Noach is holier than unless you have... holier than what?
You can't say
Shabbat is holy... Yeah, of course you say Shabbat is holier than Yom Tov when it's not Yom Tov. Of course. But we're trying to compare the two and look at them as categories of sanctity. If you look at them as categories of sanctity, Shabbat is holier. And if you look at Noach and Avraham as representing achievements of sanctity, it seems like if the rabbis are telling us Noach is Shabbat, then Noach is holier than Avraham. It's a head-to-head comparison. It's like we would take the 1956 Yankees and compare them to the 2017 Yankees. It's not real. They don't exist at the same time, but you're doing a head-to-head. And that's how you do it. So we're doing a head-to-head here too. Okay? So the Shemi Shmuel is stuck with our question. It seems like Noach is holier than Avraham. And then he comes to a beautiful answer. Okay, he says as follows in the second paragraph. Ach nireh dihinei Shabbat kviya v'kaima v'yom tov beidina mikadshin leh. There's a significant, fundamental difference between Shabbat and Yom Tov. How does Shabbat earn its sanctity? It's not a trick question. Why is Shabbat holy?
Because
it's a day that Hashem rested.
He said, keep it holy.
Because God said, it's holy.
Right.
God said, every seventh day of Shabbat, it's holy. How, in the time of the Talmud at least, how did the Yamim Tovim, the holidays, become established on when they would be and therefore when the holiness would exist? What was it based on?
Calendar.
Based on the calendar. Based on someone saying, I saw the new moon. Going to the Beit Din and saying, I saw the new moon. And the Beit Din would ask all sorts of questions to make sure that the person was correct. And the Beit Din would say, okay, if that's the case, then on the following day, it's going to be Yom Tov. So it was the Beit Din, not God. God said, you have to figure it out. But the day, the actual day, it's hard for us to understand this. If we open up a calendar, I could see when Sukkot is going to be for the next 1,000 years. But back in the day, it wasn't Sukkot until the Beit Din said, it's Sukkot. Right? There's a famous debate in the Talmud between two rabbis, one who thought it was Yom Kippur, and one who thought it wasn't Yom Kippur, and the one who thought it was Yom Kippur. The one who thought it wasn't Yom Kippur who was in charge. He made a lower rabbi carry his wallet to him on the day that the other rabbi thought was Yom Kippur. Because that's not the way it works. You can't decide when it's Yom Kippur. The Beit Din decides when it's Yom Kippur. Or Sukkot or anything else like that, right? So That's a fundamental difference. So now with that, yes?
I just need to clarify. So Noah is Shabbat because God said...
Wait, hold on. We're going to unfold it right now. Excellent. V'al kein. Mitzvat Shabbat midoraita. Hi shivita mimelacha. Shishay v'al taseh. Sheshabbat ba me'elav. Therefore, Shabbat, from the Torah, we stop all types of activity. We don't do anything. Sheshabbat ba me'elav. Shabbat comes automatically. A human being, a Beit Din, doesn't have to do anything. Every seventh day is Shabbat, whether the Beit Din has nothing to do with it. V'hu kivia v'kaima. It exists. All we have to do is protect the sanctity of the Shabbat. So we do not ruin the sanctity of Shabbat, right? By undermine it by working. But Yom Tov only becomes sanctified when the Beit Din does it. Haynu sheYisrael atzmam moshchim hakedusha. The Jewish people themselves draw out the holiness. Okay? So now, what about Abraham and Noach? Ubedimyon ze haya hefresh sheben Noach lehavot. Now we can understand the difference between Noach and Lehavot, and now he's going to turn the whole thing upside down, and in the end, Abraham is going to be the winner. How does he do this? Shenoach hayta lo hakadusha mitoldato. Noach was born holy. Right? Tamim haya b'dorotav. God didn't have to tell him. He didn't have to do anything. Like you said, no inner work. All of a sudden, here I am. Noach's perfect. He was born that way. Just like Shabbat is born holy. V'chol avodato hayta rak l'shmor atzmo shelo yifgemuhu b'nei doro. Noach's work was what? Just protecting his sanctity. Not allowing it to become corrupted from his generation. That's why the Torah says that Noach was, meaning from all the way back from his childhood, from his birth, he was pure. Lashon avar, this is language of the past. Haya, sheme olam haya tamim ve'eno mipri masav klal. This is beautiful and at the same time a big indictment on Noach. Noach's sanctity was from his birth. The eino mi prima sabklal, and was not the fruit of his labor at all. He had nothing to do with it. He was born, we'll put it this way, spiritually speaking, with a silver spoon in his mouth. He did not have to earn it at all. The harabuta shelo, the chol avodato v'asiyoto hayta b'meshit ameitz shelo yimshichuhu b'nei dor aleihem. And what was his greatness? That he did not let everyone else in that generation corrupt his holiness. Aval Avraham, now that's the top of page 2. Kol ma shehayalo haya hakol mipri masav. Avraham was born like the rest of us, just a regular Joe. And everything that he attained, spiritually speaking, now, was literally mipri masav, the fruit of his labor. Sherei toldoto hayta miterach shebal ishto b'meini data. He says his beginnings were all shady beginnings. Right, his father Terach, he had an inappropriate relationship with his wife, according to Kabbalah. Ela shehu ba'avodato mashach alav kedusha elyonam od. He, because of the inner work, like you said, right? You got it right away. He brought down sanctity on himself. And if you keep continuing, v'hu mamash kemo yom tov. That's why Avram is compared to the yamim tovim, the festivals. Because the festivals only become sanctified if we do something to make them sanctified. Just like Avram only became Tamim, or was on his way to becoming Tamim, because of his work. Uvichein yuvan shema deita b'zor HaKadosh Noach hu Shabbat. Lo mipat mahu takadusha. So, what does it mean that Noach is Shabbat? Not because of a level of sanctity. Shehi gedola mikulam. Which would not make sense, because Shabbat is the holiest. The quality of the sanctity that Noah had was automatic. But rather, because he's like Shabbat, which exists, the holiness exists no matter what. Aval ha'avot, af she b'mahut ha'kedusha hayta shalehem gedola mishelo, their essential sanctity was greater than Noach's. Mikol makom be'ikut, when it comes to the quality of it, domeli yom tov, that's more like yom tov, because they, it had to be earned as opposed to being born with it. And then he answers the question at the end, v'alkein yuvan madichtiv be'i be'avram hitalech lefanai ve'heyetamim. Now we understand why God told Avraham, walk with me and become holy. Hamshachat, lashon sivui. This is a command to Avraham. Shehu be'atzmo yasezeh. You have to do it on your own, God says to Avraham. Sheyet tamim be'inyan hamshachat ha'kedusha alav, shenemaz b'tevot hitalech lefanai. Also, hitalech lefanai. Walk with me, meaning this is going to take some effort on your part, Avraham. This is not going to be so easy. Lefi ayinu shamshachat ha'kedusha tiyeh b'li chisaron. If you keep doing it, so it ends up becoming complete and perfect. So the Shem Yishmuel, the Shachat Shav Rebbe, turns the whole thing upside down, right? That Noach is compared to Shabbat, not because his holiness is greater, but because his holiness is automatic. Who has, in the Shem Yishmuel's analysis, who has greater Kedusha? Avraham, because he earned it, as opposed to Noach, who, like we said, was born with a spiritual silver spoon in his mouth.
It also goes for your own traits, which I find this really comforting, that if you have a quality that's not so great that you're working on, you don't have to go straight to very good.
Yes.
You can go from not so good to good.
Right. Or from terrible to not so terrible.
Yeah.
Right.
And if you have a quality that you came with, so that maybe chesed is easy for you, then you have to go to very, very good.
Excellent.
I
right.
like that idea.
Right. So this is the Shem Yishmuel's ode to the self-made person. That that quality of sanctity is greater. So, but here's the question, and with this we'll just quickly look at something in the Rambam, and then we'll be done. So here's the question: who really is greater? Let's just take an example. Let's say a person has a desire to steal. Two people: one person has a desire to steal, another person who has no desire at all to steal. The person who has no desire at all to steal, since they have no desire at all to steal, doesn't steal. They're perfect. Let's just take it in the one example, the context of theft, they're perfect. You have the other person who wants to steal, but never does because they keep fighting it off.
They're the better one.
Who's better?
The one that fights to be better.
Okay, now let me ask another question. Let's say you have one person, I'll give an extreme example, who has no desire to be a pedophile, and another person who has a desire to be a pedophile all the time,
but doesn't
do it because they fight it off.
Still the fighter.
Still? Who would you rather be?
Who would I rather be?
Yeah.
I'd rather be the one not with the temptation.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
But
you're welcome.
I'm
glad you put that on record for everybody.
I would be quite proud of myself if I was the one with the temptation and I didn't act on it.
Okay. So this is an interesting question because I'm not sure if everyone would agree as to who's better, right? Who's not better? Who's considered
doing the best
holier? Who's considered holier,
doing
right?
The best work.
In the language of the Rambam asks this in a fascinating essay, which is source number 4. We're not going to read the whole thing, but it's a fascinating essay. He says on page, this is on page 2, source number 4, philosophers maintain that though the man of self-restraint performs moral and praiseworthy deeds, yet he does them desiring and craving all the while for immoral deeds, like let's say the person who wants to steal, but subduing his passions and actively fighting against a longing to do those things in which his faculties, his desires, and his psychic disposition excite him, succeeds, though with constant vexation, in acting morally. This saintly man, however, is guided in his actions by that to which his inclination and disposition prompt him, in consequence of which he acts morally from innate longing and desire. Philosophers unanimously agree that the latter is superior to and more perfect than the one who has to curb his passion. So the Rambam says, the philosophers say, the first guy is more perfect, the one who never wants to steal, the one who never wants to do any type of negative act, he's more perfect. Right? Philosophers unanimously agree that the latter is superior to and more perfect than one who has to curb his passions, although they add that it is possible for such one to equal the saintly man in many regards. That's the philosopher's view. Turn the page. And then he gets to the rabbinic view, where he says, in the middle, I'm sorry, I didn't mark it off right here in the middle. Look where my finger is. It's on the next page, paragraph 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 lines down from the beginning of paragraph 2, sort of in the middle of the line. Right, where it says, when, however, we consult the rabbis on this subject, it would seem that they consider him who desires iniquity and craves for it, but does not do it, more praiseworthy and perfect than one who feels no torment in refraining from evil. So the Rambam is setting up a debate here between the philosophers who disagree with Elisheva and the rabbis who agree with Elisheva.
Thank you.
The rabbis say, no, the more perfect person is the person who desires evil but fights it off. And the philosophers are saying, no, the more perfect person is the one who has either born or developed themselves into a situation where they never have a desire for anything or whatever negative act we're talking about. So which is it? Who's right?
What's the definition of perfect?
Well, let's say in that thing, the person
perfect
has...
Is perfect someone who will always do the right thing?
Or is perfect someone who never wants to do the wrong thing? That's the debate.
There'd be absolutely no reason for
that's the debate
here.
What's that?
We're talking about really extreme, horrible things for a moment there, then. There'd be no purpose in us being here if we weren't trying to refine our souls or get better.
So we're not talking about someone who was born that way. Let's say you have a person who has worked on themselves to the point where they no longer have a desire to steal.
But the other person...
And the person still has a desire to steal,
but
they fight it off each every time.
Both came with a desire.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. It's not... We're not talking about a situation where... Yeah, the person... We're all the same. We're all human, right? We all... And so I work... one person does the inner work necessary, and that's it. They've overcome it. And this other person can't overcome it, the desire for it, but they don't act on it.
Well, I still think it's that person.
Okay. So the Rambam is setting up this debate. But then he says it's not a really debate at all. Next page, number 3. Right, this is sort of the Noach Avraham. A little bit different, but sort of similar. Noach never has a desire, was perfect, and whatever that means, and Avraham had to work on himself, so who's better? So, number 3. At first blush, by superficial comparison of the sayings of the philosophers and the rabbis, one might be inclined to say that they contradict one another. Such, however, is not the case. Both are correct, and moreover, are not in disagreement in the least. As the evils which the philosophers term such, and of which they say that he who has no longing for them is more to be praised than he who desires them, but conquers his passions, are things which all people commonly agree are evils, such as shedding of blood, theft, robbery, fraud, injury to one who has done no harm, ingratitude, contempt for parents, and the like. The prescriptions against these are called commandments, about which the rabbi said, if they had not already been written in the law, it would have been proper to add them. Meaning things that we would have come up on our own. I didn't need the Torah to tell me not to kill. I don't need the Torah to tell me not to smack you in the face for no reason. So when it comes to those, the Rambam, that's what the philosophers mean. It's better to be a person who has no desire to hit their fellow person for no reason. Okay? If they had not already been written in the law, it would have been proper to add them. Some of our later sages who are infected with the unsound principles of the mutakalimun, called these rational laws. There is no doubt that a soul which has a desire for and lust after the above-mentioned misdeeds is imperfect, that a noble soul has absolutely no desire for any such crimes and experiences, no struggle is refraining from them. When, however, the rabbis maintain that he who overcomes his desire has more merit and greater reward, they say only in reference to laws that are ceremonial prohibitions. This is quite true, since were it not for the law, they would not at all be considered transgressions. Let's say eating treif. So when it comes to something which everyone agrees is immoral and wrong, it's better to never have that desire. That's more perfect. When it comes to who the rabbis think is overcoming and who the rabbis think is a more developed spiritual being, the person who overcomes, now we're talking about things which not everyone agrees are necessary. Like, unless you're Jewish, you don't agree that you shouldn't eat a cheeseburger. Right? That's not for everyone. This is quite true. Since were it not for the law, they would not at all be considered transgressions. Therefore, the rabbis say that man should permit his soul to entertain the natural inclination for these things, but the law alone should restrain him from them. It's interesting. All along the lines of what you said, Elisheva, the rabbis are saying, no, if you don't desire the cheeseburger, then what mitzvah are you doing by not eating it? Maybe, which is, I think, not so simple, but maybe that's what the Rambam is saying. Therefore, the rabbis say that man should permit his soul to entertain the natural inclination for these things, but the law alone should restrain him from them. Ponder over the wisdom of these men of blessed memory, manifest in the examples they adduce. Back page. They do not declare, man should not say, I have no desire to kill, to steal, and lie, but I have a desire for these things, yet what am I to do, since my Father in heaven forbids it? They don't say that, because you don't kill only because God says don't kill. You don't kill because that's just normal, moral, basic behavior. The instances they cite are all from the ceremonial law, such as partaking of meat and milk together, wearing clothes made of wool and linen, and entertaining into the consanguineous marriages. Right? If I go into a place to buy a suit and it has shatnez, all right, that's a really nice suit. I'd love to have it, but I can't have it because the Torah says no shatnez. That's great. But I should not also say, I really would like to kill that person, but I'm not going to because the Torah says don't kill. No, in that case, you should be, I have no desire at all to kill that person. Why should I want to do that? These and similar enactments are what God called my statutes, chukim, which the rabbis say are statutes which I, God, have enacted for thee, which thou hast no right to subject to criticism, which the nations of the world attacks, and which Satan denounces, etc. So the Rambam at first sets up a false argument between the two, and says, no, they're not really arguing. When it comes to things that morally balanced people all agree are improper, it's better for us never to have that desire. That's the more morally developed person. When it comes to things which are only ritually prohibited, then what we should have, Rambam is saying it's a virtue, which is, again, a complex thing to say, but the Rambam is saying it's a virtue to want to do it, but say, I'm not going to do it because God told me not to.
So every time we pass a sausage sizzle, and I don't even eat meat, but I'm desirous of whatever that is,
and then you don't eat it,
you're becoming more holy.
Rambam says that's the virtuous move. Correct. Yeah. Again, which is, it's not so simple because I'm not so sure if it's so easy to say, since I don't desire a cheeseburger, I'm not performing a mitzvah. I mean, the Rambam seems to be saying I have to activate my will against myself in order to fulfill the mitzvah.
Well, the automatic olfactory nerve that says...
Right, it's like Pavlov's dog.
Yes.
I need to be a Pavlov's dog, but not go after the steak.
That's right. Yes.
Right, in order to fulfill the mitzvah. Which I'm not so sure if that's true. I don't necessarily see it that way. Right? If I never desire a cheeseburger, I should get credit by going through my whole life not eating one, even though I didn't desire one. The Rambam is saying, I'm not so sure.
I'm not so
sure
either.
Maybe you didn't desire it because you were told all your life. Because
right, so why should I suffer for that?
Margarine on a baked potato when I'm eating meat. I can do it with fish.
Right.
I cannot do
right.
it with meat.
So why should you suffer for that? Why should you suffer for
like,
right?
You know, but that's just neurotic.
I'm saying, why should I suffer? Why should I not get credit? Why should one who was brought up their whole life observant and therefore never in a million years thought they're going to eat a cheeseburger, not get credit for not eating one?
The idea of cheese and meat, I don't eat meat, but the idea of a cheeseburger makes me physically ill.
So, which means you're not getting credit for it, according to the Rambam.
But I am. You put a sausage sizzle out there.
But that's you.
That you do.
But
okay.
That's you.
All
right.
Not everybody.
No, but we're talking about why I should get credit for one and not the other. I understand why I'd be getting credit for the one I'm desirous of versus the one I'm not desirous of.
Right. Okay. Well, everybody, that about wraps it up for today. Thank you all. Yes, Ron. Some sort of improper sexual relationship.
If you were just born like this,
it could be any number of different types.
Try it and see. Wow, this tastes good.
All right, we're signing off, everybody. Thank you.